From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And first on the show this morning is former Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Roger Thoreau, who will be talking about his new book, Against the Grain, how farmers across the globe are transforming agriculture to nourish the world and heal the planet.
That's right. Thoreau traveled to Africa, India, Central America, and even parts of the U.S. to learn how farmers there are turning away from modern forms of farming, pesticides, monocultures, deforestation, to a new kind of agriculture, one which nourishes both humans and the land, and following their lead could help us solve one of the great crises of our time. Roger Thoreau and his book, Against the Grain, in the first part of the show.
And then in the second half, New York Times bestselling author Amy Stewart joins us to talk about her book, The Tree Collectors. When Stewart discovered a community of tree collectors, she expected to meet horticultural fanatics driven to plant every species of oak or maple. But what she discovered was that the urge to collect trees springs from something deeper and more profound, a longing for community, a vision for the future, or a path to healing and reconciliation. Amy Stewart and her book, The Tree Collectors, in the second half of the show.
Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. And joining us for the first part of the show is Roger Thoreau. He is, among other things, Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent, or former Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent, and the author of several books, including his latest titled Against the Grain, How Farmers Around the Globe Are Transforming Agriculture to Nourish the World and Heal the Planet. Roger, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Hey, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, pleasure is ours. And I thought we would start with you because if I understand your background, you do a lot of work or have done a lot of work in the area of food and agriculture, global affairs, et cetera. You're on the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. If I have this right, you're at Auburn University. Scholar in residence for the Hunger Solutions Institute. Is that correct?
Yes. So that's right. I have been, yes, for the last several years.
What does that involve?
There's some teaching involved in the classes. They have a hunger studies minor here, which is really forward thinking and looking at the causes and consequences of hunger, how it continues to abide and persist in our world today. Kind of no matter where it may be, you know, overseas, anywhere, or also in our country, where I've written a lot about the kind of horrible oxymoron of the hungriest people in the world are farmers and smallholder farmers, and here in this country we have our own awful hideous oxymoron of hungry Americans, and so that's one of the main things we look at.
Right. So, it's interesting, like I say, ironic that some of the poorest and hungriest people on the planet are farmers. Can you give us some examples of that globally or even here in the U.S.?
Yes. I mean, we have, and kind of as I do in the Against the Grain, we journey to some of the world's oldest agricultural areas, as you had mentioned, so kind of Africa's Great Rift Valley, so Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, to the Indo-Gangetic Plain in India, which sweeps beneath the Himalayas, the Pan-American Highlands, so the volcanic slopes of Guatemala and the rooftop of the Andes in Peru with the potato farmers there, and into the Great Plains of the U.S., wheat farmers in Kansas, the Lakota community in South Dakota and their efforts to regain their food sovereignty. And so we meet farmers and ranchers in all these places whose efforts to earn a living and feed their families and communities have turned against them, resulting in malnutrition in their own families, hunger, famine at times. They by kind of conforming to modern agriculture practices, they've witnessed their lands degrading, their soil's depleting, their water's dwindling, their forest disappearing, their pollinators fleeing, their biodiversity shrinking, their rain's becoming ever more mercurial and their temperatures ever hotter. And so this puts great strain on their efforts. And so what we find is this kind of this great collision of humanity's two supreme imperatives. When you think about it, you know, our imperatives to nourish the planet, to nourish us, to nourish us all, and at the same time to preserve the planet from the very actions of nourishing us. And that's upon these farmers. And these are their efforts of to alter their farming, to change their farming, to question, to diversify, and to be able to reconcile their roles as both farmers, as nourishers of us, and as stewards of our land and our planet.
Yeah, and to dive deeper into that in just a little bit, I did grow up in Michigan, and I grew up around farmers. And going back home, it is a very different feeling than, you know, I'm going to give my age away, but I grew up in the 80s as a child.
Oh.
And it was a different, it was different. I felt like there were a lot of people that were growing their own gardens. There was a lot more small farmers doing that sweet corn that we love so much. But now I feel like when I go home, like you said, I am surprised by the lack of nutrition in the food that my neighbors are eating now as compared to then, and how the farming has changed, and it's not so much the small farmer, but it's these larger entities that are buying up these lands and right. taking over. You'd think it would produce something more for that community, but it actually takes away from the community.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and I grew up in Northern Illinois, maybe a decade earlier or two than you.
Making me feel better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll make you feel better. It was obviously Northern Illinois and the heartland of the corn and the soybeans and the wheat and the Midwest breadbasket, as it's come to be known. We'd have farmers and their tractors kind of come through downtown, you know, Crystal Lake, Illinois, at times during the planting season, during the harvesting, you know, on their way to their little fields. And there might be kind of little parcels of field scattered around, you know, maybe a larger main field. And now, you see the farms that are, you know, just huge. And all the my relatives, my uncles and aunts on my mom's side of the family, she grew up on a farm in outside of Chicago. They were all farmers and family farmers. And you see, this consolidation. So you'll still find farms that are, you know, maybe a couple of hundred acres, but now it's also growing into thousands and thousands of acres, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 acres at some places as you get farther west. And you have to wonder, and we kind of explore this, in, at least certainly in the U.S. Sections in our own Midwest part of the book, what happens to these communities, particularly to the nutritional qualities and benefits in these communities, we see kind of a resurgence, hopefully, of farmers markets. But when they've gone away, then, you know, how does that translate then into the nutritional status of our communities?
Absolutely.
I'll join in on the dating party, because back in the 60s when I was growing up, I would get my weekly reader or watch those films, those grainy black and white films produced by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, probably, about the Green Revolution and Norman Borlaug and how his research was going to, revolutionize the way crops, maybe certain, not all crops, but certain crops were grown, rice and wheat, et cetera, and the advent of improved mechanization of farms, fertilizers, and of course, the advent of different of chemicals in the form of pesticides, herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, rodenticides, all those sides, right, Roger? And how that was going to change things, not just for the American farmer, but more importantly, globally. But there were consequences associated with those things. Talk about that.
Yes, thank you. And you're absolutely right. And the consequences are precisely what we're seeing now. I mean, I had the great fortune while still at the Wall Street Journal, along with my colleague Scott Kilman, who was the journal's lead agriculture writer for many years, to spend some time with Dr. Borlaug and to kind of understand, you know, more about the thinking or his philosophy and goal of everything. You know, he and his colleagues at the time, they were looking at the Green Revolution not as like a static moment in time, but more as an evergreen revolution that one needed to fine tune and to adapt and to, you know, see the consequences of. And so, you know, he recognized that, you know, the increasing use of fertilizer and all these sites that you had mentioned, the pesticides and the insecticides had introduced a new element of pollution to the world. We see it in the kind of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, the runoff down the Mississippi, and a lot of it coming from farms, but also from industrial waste. And so he was like, you know, saying in one of his prophecies was one of the things that he would turns out to be very prophetic on, was that, you know, if we allow complacency to strike, if we don't kind of keep up with this and turn the Green Revolution into an evergreen revolution, you know, we'll be guilty of criminal negligence if hunger and malnutrition continue to abide and persist in our world. And, you know, one thing the Green Revolution did accomplish back at that time in the 50s and the 60s was to increase agriculture production, to knock back famine in certain parts of the world, particularly in the subcontinent in India, Pakistan and other areas of Asia, and then it kind of spreads to other parts of the world, but really not Africa. And so kind of these advances in agriculture production, you know, didn't come to all parts of the world. But that came with a cost. And, you know, one saw kind of the subsidies in India, say for electricity, so the farmers could keep their irrigation units and systems running. Well, that, you know, greatly depleted the water levels.
Right.
We have examples in the book of farmers from India who, when they were young, maybe they could get water from their well on their home farm, kind of by just reaching into the well with a bucket or a cup and getting water out. Mm-hmm. Now that well is closed because, you know, and the farmer says, gee, now we have to dig other wells and maybe go, you know, 50 feet, 100 feet, or 50 meters, 100 meters, you know, far down, and then have, you know, some kind of contraption that will lower the bucket there, or even have kind of electricity that can bring it up if they have that. And so that's kind of one example of seeing that. And then, you know, as you mentioned, then the insecticides, pesticides, all in this attempt to increase production,
right,
and intensify production. That has had an impact on the pollinators, the biodiversity, all these allies that are so important to agriculture. The monocropping of crops to make the farming that was thought this is a way that the farming can become more efficient, to increase the income of the farmers, increase their the productivity of their land. And so by monoculture, it's like growing one crop,
right,
kind of year after year. So be it corn, wheat, you know, soybeans, other beans, you know, other crops that farmers around the world may be growing. But that had a tremendous toll on the soil and the soil nutrients, that when you constantly do that year after year, you're pulling the same nutrients out of the soil, and what are you replacing them with? And so,
right, you're replacing them with fertilizer to supplement and add in back in the phosphorus or the nitrogen that was lost by the monocropping. So it's this treadmill of complications that arise. Let me reintroduce you. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Roger Thoreau. He's the author of the new book, Against the Grain, How Farmers Around the Globe Are Transforming Agriculture to Nourish the World and Heal the Planet. So you've gone through the list of challenges and complications and consequences to the environment as a result of of a modern form of agriculture, we'll say. And where is, let's turn to the transformational part. Where is that happening and what does it look like?
Yeah, you see it happening in all parts of the world. In a lot of instances led by these very smallholder farmers, you know, farmers, you know, in Africa and India and other parts of the world that may be growing their crops to feed their families and their community and their neighbors, maybe on 1 or 2 acres or a couple of acres of land. There's like 500 million of them in the world or so. The indigenous farmers around the world, the family farmers that we're familiar with in this country, that we used to be more familiar with, and those numbers have also greatly diminished as we see this consolidation that you had mentioned earlier. And so a lot of them are leading the way in this transformation, in these efforts towards food sovereignty. So say with our Native American community and like within the Lakota community up in South Dakota, an effort to reestablish the buffalo herds, you know, and the regenerative actions that come from that, and the restoring of the prairie lands, the efforts to reinduce their old and reclaim their old practices of farming, and you know, so kind of with the as you were mentioning with the Green Revolution, that you know, we kind of, you know, lost track of, you know, we thought we had all the answers, or many people thought we had the answers. But I think what we've realized, and particularly these farmers are seeing, is that, you know, we weren't even asking the right questions, if asking any questions at all. And so these farmers are questioning, they're challenging, why do we have this these monoculture practices? It's really made us dependent on a single crop that, okay, maybe it's more efficient. And if the prices are right, then, you know, the income may be greater, mm-hmm. but you're basically, you know, nailing yourself or tying yourself to that one single crop, and the prices there that will fluctuate up and down. The farmers don't control the price of the crops that they're growing. You know, if a pest comes or a disease comes through, you know, gee, then what do? So these farmers are looking at more diversification. They're through crop rotation, through crop diversity, through kind of, you know, just biological practices of natural pesticides, you know, fertilizer, through composting, through natural means, to reestablish and regather their and rebuild up their soils. And we see this kind of in throughout the United States and on our Great Plains and our prairie of the Midwest, the toll that the annual tilling and plowing of the annual crops of wheat, corn, some of our staple crops, you know, what that has done to the organic matter of the soils that may have been 6, 7, 8% at some time, you know, back in say a century ago. Or more, you know, now those organic matter of the soils might be down to, you know, 2 or 3% or even less. And it's that organic matter that really helps the crops grow, which then can be modified, you know, or modified some by fertilizer. But that kind of masks the efforts that need to go. Right. So these farmers are kind of seeing, you know, the future of the degraded lands and the degraded soils. And it's quite ugly the way that they describe it and what they've been through. But they've managed to and worked hard to reclaim their soils, to let their soils and their land rest if they have the ability to do that, and to get, you know, food aid from the World Food Program or others. That becomes more of a, instead of a handout, it becomes kind of a food for work for the farmers to restore their land and regenerate their land. So these whole efforts of agroecology, of agroforestry, of working with nature, of regenerative agriculture, working with nature instead of bending nature to to your will.
Right. And that's what the farmers
see, the consequences of this. And in essence, as I said, how their agriculture is turned against them.
Right. Yeah, and to that point, maybe looking more forward than acting in the moment. I worked in Vietnam for a nonprofit for a little while called Windrock, and they were speaking to farmers who are planting cashew, and it is causing a lot of deforestation there. Yes. But the yield seems faster and the money seems quicker, but they were trying to, in a very slow way, get an understanding that if you plant bamboo, you can plant it amongst the forest so you don't lose these natural habitats and that you will get a yield and you will have more money, and they're looking towards the future. But now it sounds like that's a mindset in farmers globally instead of what is happening in this minute. We are thinking about sustainable ways in which the land can be farmed and what that yield looks like year after year after year after year.
Absolutely. And so you have farmers like the farmer who begins to book, opens to book with Abebe Maliso in Ethiopia. And he asks right away, he shows me his farm, and it's this wild, array of diversity, all sorts of vegetables and herbs and kind of a kitchen garden. And then he has, some of the more of the main crops, but instead of like just one maize or corn that they had kind of monocropped for years, his family. Now he's got like little patches of it, of a whole wild variety of crops, farming with integrated trees into it. And so his land was dead, and they had to move off their land, let it rest, let it restore. And then the work that they did to kind of terrace the land to catch the rainwater, because it had become so hard and barren that when the rains came, and the mercurial nature of them, that when it came, it just hit and ran off. It didn't even soak into the soil because it was so hard. So to kind of refashion the soil and the land to reclaim the water, to stop the erosion, suddenly the grasses come back, the bushes come back, the water then accumulates, not only in the soil, but builds up the water level, the groundwater level. All of a sudden, spring started reappearing. And then the bees come. And so he started some beehives and beekeeping, and he's planted a wide variety of fruit trees around the hem of his, and he only has like 4 acres or something. And I said, gee, that must be a lot of work, to have this such a diversified farm and tend to all these different crops with the various seasons and things.
Yeah.
And he said, had you ever thought about just growing maize? And he looked at me very quizzically, as if I had asked like a ridiculous question. And he says, why would I do that? We've done that. That's what's gotten us to this stage, that our land was dead. And now when you look and you think, he goes on a little tour of his farm and he says, look, you can see our land that was dead is now living again. So asking these questions, why would I do that? Has become really, really crucial in reforming. He challenges, he wants to learn. He says, I have an open mind of approaching this. And this is what you find all over. And in Uganda, there's a farmer, Daniel Sebakaki, who had some cattle. He had some trees and forest on his land, and the cattle was kind of grazing in the forest, but he was also growing some maize and rice and some other crops. And then all of a sudden the sugarcane wave came, and he said, well, I'll get in on that because it's promising great riches.
Right.
And so he cut down, sugarcane does not get along well with trees. And so he cut down his forest. He kind of leveled everything that he had on, 8 acres or so, and he planted sugarcane. And by the time the sugarcane came up, well, everybody was doing the same thing. And the sugarcane factory said, we're full. We can't take any more sugarcane. All those of you with the sugarcane in the fields, sorry, we can't take any more. He scrambled to find other places that he could sell to, other producers, and he couldn't find any. And then one night he gets a call from one of his neighboring farmers and says, oh, your sugarcane field's on fire. So the farmers were actually then their competitors. They were setting other fields on fire.
Wow.
And ruining their crop. So would less the number of crops of sugarcane that was then going to the factory, and maybe create opportunities for these other farmers then. And so he said, I lost it all. And he said, why did I do that? I cut down all my trees. And within a matter of 10 minutes or so, he used the word regret a half dozen times. He so regretted his actions of working against nature, of bending nature to the will of trying to plant sugarcane and get the riches from that. And he said, what have I done? And so now he's reestablishing the trees and his grazing, and again, in kind of an agroforestry, agroecology, to work with the nature and what he is given, as opposed to kind of bending it to the will of whatever modern agriculture forces and promises of riches are coming by.
Right, so it sounds like, and we only have a minute or two, it sounds like they have to understand that perhaps they have to trade the pursuit of riches for the pursuit of, well, riches in terms of money, for the pursuit of riches in terms of, say, a quality of life that may not be as wealthy in
or
financially,
immediately,
but yeah, wealthy in terms of longevity and diversity.
Yeah, I mean, so all farmers, you need income. Right. So the farm, so they have their farming become sustainable. So you need income, and you need, the nutritious aspect of the food, and you need the sustainability of the land. And so that's what they're looking at. So how do we have all these factors? How can we do all that in what we're doing? So to be able to have our living, to have a farm that we can then pass on to the next generations. To be growing nutritious crops, not just crops for calories, but for their nutrition as well. And then that will also preserve the land and retain the value of the soil and the trees and the climate. Because what Daniel found is that once he and everybody else was cutting down trees, all of a sudden they said it got really hot. The wind stopped blowing. Mm-hmm. The rains, which were always mercurial, became even more so. And ever more scarce. And so they realized that their whole microclimate had changed by what they were doing. So these aspects of climate change, and then to combat, what they see in a really real sense, the changing climate, some of that they see is coming from their own hands. And what can they do to act against that? So,
well, unfortunately, we have to wrap up. The name of the book, again, is Against the Grain: How Farmers Around the Globe Are Transforming Agriculture to Nourish the World and Heal the Planet. The author is Roger Thoreau, among other things. Roger is currently a scholar in residence at the Auburn University College of Human Sciences. Roger, website for yourself, for people to learn more about your book and your other books and writings?
Yeah, the website, I have one that was formerly with the Chicago Council. It's Outrage and Inspire. .org.
I love it.
and that's, yeah, my mantra as a journalist is to outrage and say, look at kind of how have we brought hunger and malnutrition with us into the 21st century, but also the inspiration of all these farmers in the book, this book and others that I've written about that are doing something about it.
We love moving into Inspire always at the end of the show.
Yes.
So we appreciate your hope forward.
Yes, and we appreciate you taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth, Roger Thoreau.
Thank you. Delighted to do so, and thanks for raising these issues.
All right.
Appreciate
it. We'll be in touch.
We absolutely will. We have so much more to talk about.
Yes. All right.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to turn our attention to trees, right, Claire?
Absolutely. We will be speaking with Amy Stewart, who has written a book called The Tree Collectors. This is going to be an exciting interview coming up in just a moment. Stay with us right here on This Green Earth. We are going to turn our attention now to New York Times bestselling author Amy Stewart, who joins us to talk about her book, The Tree Collectors. Thank you so much for joining us today,
Amy. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. So we are excited to dive deep into this with you. I think that the premise of this book is just genius. I love storytelling myself, and you are a true storyteller. And not only are you a storyteller, you're a collector of stories, which I think is interesting because of the book title, The Tree Collectors. So first of all, let's get into a little bit about you, Amy. We like to kind of set the stage. You have written The Drunken Botanist and a lot of other fun books. So what led you to this book?
Yeah, you know, I've been writing about plants and the natural world for a long time. So there's a whole string of other books about plants before this one came out. But what I've really always done is written about people, you know? So like I wrote a book about the global flower industry, but it was really about the people that work in that industry, not just the flowers themselves. So that's kind of always been my thing. And about 10 years ago, somebody came up to me at one of my events and told me that he was a tree collector. And I just thought, what a crazy thing to collect. I mean, trees are really big and they're hard to move. And I don't even really understand how this works. But I just kept thinking about it. And sort of every few years, I would meet another tree collector. And it's like, oh, there's a lot of you out there. Like, what is this about?
Yeah. And when you say tree collector, it does invoke that thought that they are all building their own forests. And some actually are in the book, but there are several different ways of being a tree collector. Can you walk us through some of the ways in which the people in your book have been collecting trees?
Yeah, so I really wanted this to be a book for everyone, you know? So I talked to people all over the world, people from all walks of life, and who collect trees in different ways. So the thing you might think of, or sort of the traditional way to be a tree collector, is, you know, you have a large plot of land and you're super interested in Japanese maples or oak trees or conifers. And so you're trying to get as many different varieties as you can. Like, that's what most people think of. If they've ever thought about tree collectors, that's what they think of. But I talk to people who collect trees on a really small backyard, people who collect bonsai, of course, people who graft 40 different varieties of fruit onto just one tree. So like you can be a tree collector with just one tree. And, you know, people who collect parts of trees like pine cones or leaves or wood samples. There's a International Society of Wood Collectors, and they're just trying to get samples of every different kind of wood they can from around the world.
So when you were seeking out these people, what kind of net did you cast, or did you go to certain world communities that you really wanted to give a voice to? It seems it was the latter, that you actually were very purposeful about who you gave a voice to.
Yeah, definitely. I well, one thing is that collectors know other collectors, right? So if you're into collecting, you know, stamps or classic cars or whatever, you know other people who do that. So I would always ask people if they knew any other collectors. And what I very specifically always said was, you know, I'm looking for collectors who are outside of North America and Europe, because it's very easy to find tree collectors in North America and Europe. So I'm looking for people outside of those areas. I'd like to get more women tree collectors. For whatever reason, tree collectors tend to be more men. So I wanted more women. You know, tree collectors tend to be wealthy, tend to be white. So, you know, I'm looking for people who are not white, people who are collecting trees, maybe even who don't have a huge plot of land. Because I think when you get into talking about tree collecting, it's a question of like, well, who has land and who doesn't have land and why, right? So those were the sort of questions I asked. And there are tree collecting societies. Like if you're super into maple trees or palm trees, your people are out there. And there's someone has formed an organization and they're going on field trips and they're sending out newsletters and they're networking. So I put out the word in that way as well. But the other thing I did is I went to sort of unconventional places to look for tree collectors, like TikTok and YouTube, you know, like who's out there talking about trees in a really interesting way, but they're not part of any established community necessarily.
Yeah, and we had just talked with Roger Thoreau about his book Against the Grain, and he talked to us about some Ethiopian farmers and some of the scarcity of deforestation there. And you have a story of an Ethiopian tree collector who does church trees. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, I loved this so much. So one thing you probably realize this is that the Ethiopian landscape has pretty much been denuded of trees because of farming, right? Livestock grazing will really keep trees down. But the traditional churches in Ethiopia have a little forest around each of them, because the idea is that you enter the church through the Garden of Eden, kind of. So you pass through this forest. And so I talked to an ecologist who realized that that's really all that remains of what was once an entirely forested country, and that the way to save trees in Ethiopia was to expand and protect these church forests. And so that involved going to the local priests and making this their project, not something imposed by an organization. And what the priest decided to do was to build a little stone wall around the forest, which was about protecting the trees, but was also sort of a way of welcoming people in and saying, once you're inside this, you're with us. And those stones came out of the farmers' fields, which they were happy to get the stones out. And so the size of those forests is starting to expand now. And there's 30,000 of those little church forests in Ethiopia. So a potential for them to really grow and maybe even to connect with one another again the way they used to.
I love that story.
Is there a, I'm trying to get an idea behind the motivation. What drives these people to want to collect trees and like suggest that it, you know, becomes an obsession per se, like any other form of collecting things, I guess. But is there a common motivation behind this? Is it almost kind of evolutionary or so? Does this go back to our ancient selves when we relied and lived more amongst trees and had a kind of a stronger affinity to them? What's going on with these people, so to say?
Well, you know, that was the big surprise for me. Yeah. I thought when I set out to do this book, I just thought I was going to talk to a bunch of people who were just obsessed with one type of tree
right.
or another for the same reasons that any of us get into collecting something, whether yeah. it's books or ceramics or vintage toys or whatever it might be. And but that turned out to just barely scratch the surface. And what people talk to me about over and over again is how their relationship with trees have really transformed their lives. Hmm. So I talked to a woman in England who's super into maple trees. And one of the cool things about maples is that if they drop a seed and a new young tree grows out of that seed, it's going to look wildly different from its parents. And you have the possibility to like introduce that as a new variety of maple tree hmm. into the world. And she told me that she's really had a tough time because she and her husband weren't able to have children. And she felt like it left this big hole in her life and that the trees kind of filled that hole. Huh. But then she also said, I haven't been able to give a name to a baby and I would like to give a name to a tree.
Oh,
wow.
So she's really keeping an eye out for a tree that she can sort of claim as hers and give a name to. And so what really amazed me is that everyone I talked to had a story like that, but also completely different. Like their motivations were so varied. And it gave a whole level of depth to the book that honestly, I wasn't even expecting when I started.
Well, it's interesting then. It's totally different from say collecting coins or collecting stamps or vintage train sets or something, because this is an opportunity to actually create something. In this case, almost a new variety of tree.
Right. And also, you know, the thing that a lot of tree collectors talk to me about is that when you collect trees, there's this added dimension of time.
Yeah.
Right. So anything else you might collect, any objects you might collect, sit around and gather dust. But when you put a tree in the ground, it's going to grow and change over time.
Right.
And it's probably going to outlive you.
It's a living thing.
It's a legacy, really.
But it's a living thing mm-hmm. that you have to care and provide for.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It continues to grow and change. You continue to grow and change along with it. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that it really made me think about is, and you sort of touched on this, is like, why is our relationship with trees different from our relationship with, say, rose bushes or sunflowers or tomato plants? And I think part of it is that they are multi-generational compared to our time. Like they live on another time scale that's longer than ours. So it gives us this connection to, I mean, our own mortality in a way, but also this sense that life is on a continuum and that it goes on without us. A lot of tree collectors talked about what a profound realization that was, and but also a very hopeful one. You know, one of the things that I realized is that every tree comes with hope pre-installed. You put a tree in the ground and only good things are going to happen after that. Right. It's a very life-affirming and very positive thing to do, and it makes people feel great at the end of the day.
We are speaking with New York Times bestselling author Amy Stewart about her new book she penned called The Tree Collectors, Tales of Arboreal Obsession. And you also have split up in this book the table of contents in a very interesting way. Some of the descriptors of the collectors that we are about to meet in the book come out in that table of contents. Can you share with us how you broke that up?
Yeah, you know, it's always tricky to put labels on people, but I really wanted readers to understand the different motivations and the different sort of attitudes and approaches that people bring to collecting trees. So I came up with these descriptors like healers, who were very often people who are trying to heal maybe trauma in their own lives or heal their communities. Ecologists, artists, educators, community builders whose trees have somehow brought community together, preservationists who are maybe trying to preserve something from the past. So yeah, I really tried to think about, you know, what is the very human motivation that comes from this relationship with trees, and what's a good word that I can use to describe that?
And as you go through this book, it's almost like you can choose what story will resonate with you or where you are. You know, there are times when I look around and I see how beautiful, what a beautiful place we live in, and we're very much amongst the trees, and yet then I'll see something, someone carving out the hill to build something or excavating mm-hmm. something, and I have this very preservationist feeling about me. Yeah. So right. I think in this book, it allows you to kind of touch on different aspects of your life and meet these people and gain this greater understanding. And at the end of the day, like you said, it builds this feeling of hope.
Yeah, I really wanted this to be a book that you can read in any order. You can pick it up anywhere and it'll still make sense. Mm. But I definitely think that there is this sense of optimism and kind of restoration, you know, not just restoration of the planet, but restoration of ourselves. Is just that's a common thread that really unites all these folks.
Is there a tree bank nature to collecting too, that some of these collectors are helping preserve? You mentioned the word, you know, preserve certain species as a way of banking mm-hmm. these trees for to address potential calamities, or in this case, climate change.
Yeah, you know, this was super interesting. And this is a little aspect to tree collecting that I didn't know much about, which is that, for instance, now and then, a very rare tree will be found out in the wild somewhere. And if things go well, the first thing that happens is usually they call in the botanists, you know, and this might be from somewhere like Morton Arboretum in the United States or Kew Gardens in England. Mm. The botanists come in, they figure out what we're dealing with. They try to put some kind of plan in place to preserve the tree and the area, connect with the local community. And what they'll do, though, is gather some seeds and cuttings to have sort of like a backup copy of the tree that's off-site, right? We got to keep our backups off-site. And that's called ex situ conservation. And usually those trees go first to arboretums or research centers or places like that. But eventually, they can go out to private collectors as well, usually as a fundraising auction to help the local community where the tree is and to help conserve it in the wild. So that's a very cool thing that tree collectors take a lot of pride in, is it's like, I have this tree, or maybe two or three of them, so I can provide seed if something were to happen to the other ones, right. But also I gave some money to a good cause in order to help make this happen.
And I wanted to mention, too, we haven't even touched upon the fact that you actually beautifully illustrated this book yourself.
I did. This was my first time to illustrate a book. I've been an oil painter for a long time, but I recently got into watercolor and other mediums that work better for book illustration. And I thought that if the book was illustrated, it would kind of make it feel like all of these people sort of live in the same world, like metaphorically in the same world. And I wanted it to look like a sketchbook style, you know, like not super highly technical studio portraits of the people in their trees, but more something with more intimacy and familiarity. And just like, you know, you're what I do all the time. I take my sketchbook out and I sit in a park and I just sketch. So I wanted it to have this kind of like accessibility, almost like anyone could draw these pictures kind of feeling to it. And I love doing it. It's always a privilege to make someone's portrait.
Well, I will say, I don't know that anyone has that artistic talent that you have. We could all try, but I think that it's absolutely beautiful. And when I read the table of contents, I'm looking forward to meeting people. And when you illustrate it the way you do, it makes me have this closer feeling with that subject that you're talking about. And as you look forward into this next generation of people, because often tree collectors aren't of the younger generation, they tend to be a little bit older. What would you say to maybe an aspiring tree collector?
Well, you know, that's been the cool thing. I've been out on book tour and it's amazing how fired up people get about this idea. Like, you know, lots of people come up to me and say, I want to do this. Like, this is amazing. So one thing along the lines of anyone can be a tree collector is, you know, anyone can grow trees in a couple of pots on a balcony or on your front porch. I mean, I live in a little apartment and I can go gather up acorns from a historic tree down the street from me and sprout them in a pot. But there's people in the book who do kind of like what we might call unauthorized forestry or, you know, guerrilla gardening, but for trees where they're sneaking trees out into vacant lots and, you know, other places where land that they don't necessarily own, but could use a little beautification.
Right.
But also, there are people who do tree cataloging projects where they're just cataloging and describing every tree on their street or in their community or in a park or on a college campus. And that's kind of like making a bibliography for books, right? It's still a collection. You don't own them, but you have collected them by naming them, describing them, and sort of keeping them together.
And this relationship with trees, as Chris had alluded to, is very human for us to...
It's therapeutic.
Yes, want to be a part of their world, to understand better when we go into a forest how it all works. They are so intertwined as we are as humans.
I just wish there were nameplates on all the trees that I... Because it's so difficult.
Is there an app for that?
I'm sure there is an app. Maybe, Amy, you know that... we can all appreciate trees and forests better more if we knew what was around us.
Well, and I think that's part of the fun of it. And there are apps, but I know from experience that they can be a little unreliable.
Yes.
But, you know, get a good field guide to your local area and walk around with a book, but also ask people. Like, someone in your community knows what tree that is, right? And there's a tree organization, some kind of tree nonprofit in everybody's community. And so that's the other cool thing, is walking around trying to figure out what kind of tree that is that's across the street from you is a great little citizen science moment.
Right.
And we should all do that. We should, you know, we know the names of probably 72 different soft drinks. Why don't we know the names of 72 different trees?
Absolutely. When you know about it, we talk about this all the time, you more care about it and you want to take care of it and appreciate it. Well, this is a beautiful, beautiful book with illustrations by the author herself. It is Amy Stewart, The Tree Collectors. And what is the website that we can look to learn more about you and your writings and this book?
Oh, just come to amystewart.com.
And also, the book is available pretty much everywhere, yes?
You bet.
Everywhere books are sold, yeah.
Get yourself a copy. Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciated this conversation. You're great to talk to.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Amy.
You.